Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is February 27th, 2017, and this is episode 170. I'm the host, Mark Ames, coming to you from Telescope Audio Studios here in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, and I'm on the line with the Warner, Gary Bretcher, a.k.a. John Dolan in Buenos Aires. How you doing, John?
I'm great. It's cooled off in Buenos Aires. It's a great city once it cools down. I love this place.
Well, yeah, I haven't heard you so kind of cheerful about a place. I can't remember the last time.
Well, cheer is not my specialty.
No.
You have to take a blood sample. No, we detect cheer here. It's just not appearing in the verbalizations of the creature.
Yeah,
but in this case, yeah. No, I love it.
And we're going to have on, we'll get to him in a moment, but we're going to have on a really fun story, great guest today, Joel Whitney, to talk about his book, Finks, about the CIA's role in all over American culture, sort of post-war American culture, highbrow, middle brow, Paris Review, Jackson Pollock, like just everywhere. The CIA was everywhere. I mean, they were water skiing all over the place. As they say. So anyway, we'll get to our interview with Joel Pollack pretty soon. But first, so you're saying that no teeth to report today, no knees to report today, no.
No,
I mean, because these are like real war wound stories, the ones you tell, you know, when I go back and listen to them.
Yep. I ain't going to whine today in case anybody's expecting me to. No, everything is pretty good right now.
Good.
It's a shame that RWN guest Gabriel Uriarte was here during the weeks when I was either nauseous or arthritic or in pain from the molar, because almost in the last 2 days he was here, we were able to get around. We went to some fun museums together, and I got told to keep my hands off the railing and my feet off the lines and all that stuff. And it was fun. But when Gabriel was here, I was laid up most of the time.
Mm. I mean, because I was going to say, well, we'll talk about it shortly with the episode where Robert Lowell, trying to be a cultural ambassador for America, goes to Buenos Aires.
Hilarious.
Robert Lowell from the Norton Anthology of Poetry. Yeah. Robert Lowell, you know, and tries climbing on. Can we get you to climb on any of these equestrian statues? Or is
it? Well, let's see. His method was to have six double vodkas before lunch, I think.
Don't do
that
it.
That and bipolar syndrome. Yeah. So, no.
Good. No. We'll never see you again, I think.
I'll stand next to an infantry statue, but I ain't not getting up on the equestrian ones.
Good.
And really, there are a lot of equestrian statues around here. Even Gabriel, when we were going around the city, we'd ask, who's that guy? And he'd say, I don't know.
And he knows everything, I have to say. Gabriel Uriarte is a walking encyclopedia. So, yeah, that means there are a lot of equestrian statues. So, yeah, I'm kind of getting over now. I can talk about it because I was in a daze for a couple of days here, actually, right before the last show. I think I told you a little bit about it. My son, Sam, he's 3 years old. He has swollen, I don't know if you call them impacted adenoids that completely cover his sinus. I mean, we've known that he has like sleep apnea, he snores, he breathes through his mouth all the time, he snores at night, he seems uncomfortable. In fact, he even told my wife the other night that he sleeps in a certain way, like kind of bunched up and on his stomach because he has a hard time breathing at night. And so we took him finally to an ENT, and they I actually had to hold him like a straitjacket. You know, you feel kind of bad, but you just steel yourself and say, well, it's best for him. And he's screaming bloody murder while they stick this camera up his nose and down through his sinus.
That must be terrifying.
Terrifying, I know. And, you know, you just kind of hope, well, I hope he doesn't stop trusting me after this. But I think it takes a lot more for a kid to stop trusting their parents. Anyway, so we did that, and the doctor showed us, like, where there was supposed to be black in the sinus, which would be sort of a proper hole for breathing, it was completely impacted. So he has to have a surgery. And then you don't want him to get sick before the surgeries. Surgery to have his tonsils and adenoids basically almost completely removed. And And he wound up getting sick late last week, just before we recorded the previous show. He wound up getting a cold. It didn't seem like a bad cold. He went to bed. And then around 10 at night, he woke up and started calling for me, which was unusual. And so I came in and picked him up and held him a bit. And then he started calling for my wife. I went back in our bedroom, was getting ready to go to bed. And then all of a sudden, I heard her kind of like panic. And then he sort of stumbled into my bedroom, wheezing, going, and he couldn't breathe. And he had a croup cough, which I didn't even know about croup before. But croup with completely impacted adenoids like that.
What is croup?
Croup is this cough that you get where you start, it's like they say, it's like a barking cough. And somehow it's a cough from a cold, but that can develop fast into something really dangerous. And they say, because he had it once before he had these adenoids problems. And the pediatrician then said, you know, just watch him. I mean, in rare circumstances, but it can happen. It can turn serious. And if you have any doubts, take him to an emergency. And I never took that too seriously, stupidly enough. And Sam couldn't breathe. And he was crying and begging me to help him breathe. So he was struggling to get air in, and he couldn't, and that was making him panicked and made me panicked. And I have to say, normally in panicky situations, but this hasn't happened with my kid like this before, when it's with me, I get weirdly calm.
I've seen this actually. Mark's not kidding. I've seen this happen. Yeah.
Yeah. You remember the time with the Russian cop and all that?
Yes, I do. Okay. And I thought, well, 10 years in a Russian prison. This is not going to.
Yeah. And I've done that a lot with cops in those situations when people panic. And I don't know. Somehow I get calm in those situations normally. But in this case, where it was my kid not breathing, thoughts go through your head. It was such a panic. I suddenly couldn't find my phone to call 911, and neither could my wife find hers. And I'm it probably took between a minute and a half to 2 minutes, maybe longer, but it felt like an hour to find my phone to call 911. And I didn't know what to do. And my kid is saying, you know, he just kept saying, "Daddy, Daddy." And I finally called 911, and they were rude, as they often are, rude and gruff. I guess they just sort of, you expect them to panic a little bit with you, and they're not. And they just said, you give them the address. They're sending an ambulance. They told us to sit him down. By the time the ambulance came, I mean, so he was like that, unable to breathe. He turned a bit blue at one point, and he vomited. And the ambulance guys came after they got there 7 to 10 minutes later, I would say.
Which I would think is not bad.
Bad. I don't think it was so bad. That part was okay. But so they got there, and the one thing, I did calm down, and I got Sammy to calm down and to sit down, and he was able to sort of wheeze more better and speak a little bit, and that got better. And then the ambulance people came. And he got even better, but then they listened to his breathing, they listened to his lungs, and said, no, he should definitely go to emergency. And then they didn't know which hospital to take him to. And I realized at that point, I never kind of created an emergency plan before. My wife and you think you do everything. And one thing I do not have, I have a lot of regrets, past, present, future. One I don't have is sort of not doing enough or as much as I feel like I can for my kid. And I know I have done a lot for him that has been really, really helpful to him. And that's another story. But in this case, I did not prepare for an emergency situation, which is so basic. And so the ambulance people said, which hospital should we take him to? And we sort of thought, well, maybe NYU, which is across the East River. And they were kind of, I don't even know why they were asking us. And they just said, well, no, there's a closer one in Astoria. And we took him there into the ER. And the first thing, first of all, emergency rooms are hell. We went there in an ambulance. The first time in my life I've ever been in an ambulance. You ever been in one?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so I've never been in an ambulance before. Yeah, my wife's been in a couple times, but I hadn't, with Sam. And we got there, and the first thing the nurse who first saw us finally said was, "You shouldn't have taken him here." So, how the hell do I know?
What?
They don't really have pediatrics, so they're used to dealing with adult problems, and something like croup and adenoids, they just don't, they don't really know how serious it is, or how they don't really know about what to do with it, except, oh, well, he's fine, he's breathing. Like, kids are, it's very different medicine, you know, than with an adult. I mean, an adult in his state at that time, you would probably just almost send him home. But a kid, you should x-ray him and so on. But what they did do, which helped, was give him steroids. And he wound up, it was basically like he was freebasing after that. The kid was bouncing off the walls. We brought him home. He was the happiest kid. It was literally like he did like pure eight ball of like pure Colombian cocaine there. It was the funniest thing. Yeah. He wanted to eat everything. Food, Dad, give me this. Dad, took books everywhere. Running around, you know, home, cats, chasing the poor cats around. I mean, it was pretty funny. It took a while to calm him down.
I didn't know. I didn't know steroids had a mood altering effect. I guess they do.
Yeah, like a prednisone kind of thing. But you know, the pediatrician the next day was shocked that they didn't even x-ray his chest. They literally didn't know what to do. I had to convince them that it was really serious, because otherwise where the hell would we even be there? Why would the ambulance drive us there? And they literally didn't know what to do with the kid. So now,
do you know what hospital to go to now?
Yes, no. We now know the hospital, two hospitals with emergency pediatrics to go to. We found a nurse in our building, very nice woman who, you know, has offered to help in any emergency situation. Like, we now have an emergency plan, and I didn't. And I have to admit, kind of ashamed that I panicked like that, you know, when it came to my kid, because I don't know, there's nothing more mind fucking imaginable than at your own helpless kid looks like he's dying in front of you. It's just,
well, it's to your credit that panicked you more than when you've been in danger yourself.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. But I feel like, you know, anyway, he relies on me. So I've learned my lesson, I hope, and I hope that's not going to happen again. It was very surreal.
Did they say what the odds are that this will happen again?
No, but we need to get the surgery. But of course, because he got sick, we can't have the surgery now, because you can't put a 3-year-old under general anesthetic if they've had a cold in the last week. So now we wound up, my wife did a great job of browbeating the hell out of the doctors. They wanted to put it off 2 months, and we said, there's no way. And so we got him ready for surgery next week, and we just took him out of school, and we're not, which means he's stuck at home, which is hellish for him, but we don't want him around any kids for a week so that he doesn't get sick again. And he's going to drive everybody crazy and himself crazy, but at least we'll get this over with. So, so that's my little war story. Anyways.
Pretty severe war story.
Yeah. It had me kind of in a daze for a couple of days. It really did. It just sort of, it's traumatizing, you know, it's traumatizing, and it doesn't come to any kind of resolution. It just sort of eventually fades out. Like, you're sitting there in the ambulance with your kid who's having breathing problems, and you're just looking at this and thinking, this can't be happening, but it is happening. Yeah. And I can't think about how it can't be happening, because I can only think, you know, how to make sure my kid's okay. And
and I would imagine when you have a small child, you can't look too frightened.
Exactly. Yeah. You have to, I'm constantly reminding him, trying to make the ambulance ride seem fun and trying to show how calm we are. And, you know, he has a little toy ambulance at home, and just trying to bring up stories and sing songs with him. And he loves reading books. He memorizes books. He's got this crazy memory. I don't know where he got it from, because it sure ain't my memory. And so we're just kind of like reciting books together and just get him there. So anyway, but that's all, at least knock on wood, that's all better now. It's just that we got to get those damn adenoids and tonsils out. My mother was telling me that when she was young, it was almost they took out tonsils almost prophylactically, like every
kid. That was just fading when I was a kid. But a generation before, it was the beginning of a lot of anecdotes. You know, that was, I was having my tonsils out, la, la, la. And then they decided they didn't need to do that anymore. But it sounds like they do in this case.
Anyway. Yeah, in this case. Yeah, I think then phase two was you need tonsils, they're filters or something. And then... And so everyone was kind of surprised when I said, yeah, we have to take his end. They said, are you sure? Is this a real doctor that wants to do this? I said, no, like, Sammy actually can't breathe. Okay, enough of that. Let's get to our guest, Joel Whitney. He's the author of a fantastic new book called Finks, How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Writers. Great book and really interesting and otherwise very relevant to today and also kind of shocking in parts of, I don't know where we want to start here, but first of all, I guess, Joel, thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
It's funny that you named it Finks.
There's, I love that.
I do too.
It reminded me of Mad Magazine.
Yes.
You don't want to look too far behind the curtain for things like that, but I did have a little bit of a negotiation with my editor who didn't quite get it at first.
I was just going to ask you, how did you come up with it, or was it hard to get that title for the book? Because it is a great name.
Well, there's a quote. I wish I could remember who you have saying it, but he said, "This is a magazine of finks," or something like that.
Yeah, it's actually the guy who ended up doing a lot of Latin America work for the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which we can talk about. His name is Keith Botsford. He passed away, I think, last year, actually. And he didn't speak out publicly, but behind the scenes, there were these letters where he was calling this Latin America magazine a fink magazine, meaning it was totally controlled. And I picked up on that. A few other people used the word in the book, and it struck me as a word very much from that time.
Yes.
You know, are you a collaborator or not?
Yeah,
very
I was going to
say.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I remember that. If you, a real Mad Magazine insult would be, you rat fink.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it became, it was a word from that era. I don't know, do people use it much anymore? I mean, I just remember it was definitely one of the worst sort of things you could be called when I was a little kid. Like, you know, if you fink to the teacher, fink to the principal, or...
Yeah, I actually hear an updated word. I think it's like you call people an op now if you think they're kind of bought, right?
An op, that's funny. Is that like Twitter?
Like an operator, I think.
Oh, an operator, yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, I actually heard Juno Diaz say it, like suggesting he wasn't an op to a group of young people when he had his children's book come out. And I sort of vaguely remembered hearing that as slang for like an insider with kind of undisclosed ties.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think informer is one of the most important noun areas in any slang. So it's going to generate a lot of new candidates as the squares catch on to the earlier ones.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, let's see if it ever comes back. Fink, it's a good word.
It is.
Oh, yeah.
Let's start working on that now.
Fink, yeah. You
know? So you frame the book. I mean, this is a story that's kind of, it's weird. It's sort of floated around somewhere between factual reporting, like was it Francis Saunders? Is that the book?
Yeah.
Cultural Cold War, right? And then kind of conspiracy area because we don't really know enough about it. I guess it first sort of blew open the CIA's role in producing high and middle brow American culture. It first blew open in the late 60s in Ramparts magazine, if I'm not mistaken, or was it even before then?
Yeah, there were some smaller windows into what was going on, but the big exposures tended to be around the middle 60s. And what's really interesting is that you could make the case that this is the same today. Mm-hmm. A lot of left-wing circles, you know, centrists and right-wingers like to call it the far left, a lot of them were hip to it. They just sort of assumed they knew from either the open secrets that were floating around, rumors, people who maybe drank too much and said something at parties. But it seemed like the left knew about these magazines having official ties before, you know, there were other things besides magazines, but I tried to stick for the magazines. But yeah, the conspiracy theories have all been proven, and everything I've reported in the book is from archives.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have this eureka moment when you discover that somebody has just dumped their papers. And the last chapter, which is set mostly in Afghanistan, was, I think, an example where I was the first to look critically at the papers of the character in question in that section.
The John Train section, which we'll get to in a talk, right?
Yeah, I'm not even sure what he had to do with Seton Hall, but his papers ended up somehow sitting in an archive at Seton Hall, and they were fruitful.
Yeah. So let's talk about, I guess, you know, first of all, we should explain, I mean, your book, well, you frame your look at the CIA's involvement in producing, shaping, and censoring American culture. You frame it really through the Paris Review, I mean, which is still a major magazine. I have to say, one of the first, my first reactions reading this was, you know, I never liked the Paris Review, and now I feel really good about myself for not liking it much. I mean, it's pretty clear the CIA made a very concerted effort to keep it in the center, which was always the gut feeling I had. Like, there's something, the edges are so rounded in this thing, you know, it's so tweety and kind of harmless. And,
well,
you know.
There's also, I mean, one thing that, Joel, that I noticed about your book is the strong regional foundation of all this.
Right.
I mean, Mark and I are both Californians, and I'm proud to say they weren't going around recruiting Frank Herbert or Ursula Le Guin or Jack Vance, or, I mean, PKD kind of recruited himself and got a little too hot in the schizophrenia zone, he started trying to make his own contact with the authorities. But no, they were, as I think Gore Vidal called them, the boys in the back, and nobody was bothering with them. It was mostly an Ivy League production.
Yeah, Ursula Le Guin is interesting, because when she passed away, she was still, you know, giving really hard critiques of capitalism and the publishing industry. And so there is a strain of people, and Ramparts too was basically a California creation. And I have some proud California roots. but yeah, to go back to the Paris Review, it was a necessary frame, because it's A, still around, and B, since it has, I think, existed, but you could also say posed as apolitical, depending on how ornery you want to be, for all of its life. And it's right now, it's getting, you know, woke. I think that on the Paris Review Daily, you're seeing a lot more of what people were trying to push it to do, even in the 60s, people like James Baldwin, either implicitly or explicitly, to be more inclusive of people of color, of women. The critique of it as being an all-male, all-white instrument of culture was there all along, even before anyone had any suspicions that there were CIA ties. And I will say that my first impressions of it appealed to something that I don't always want to admit that I have, which is kind of the snob appeal. Mm-hmm. It was after the New Yorker. I came up, strangely, as a poet. And after the New Yorker, it seemed like the Paris Review was the highest place to get published in a magazine. And I had professors at grad school who were did stints as the poetry editor there. And that was always attractive.
Where were you? I've been through this too. I wasted decades on poetry. Where were you studying?
I did my MFA at Columbia with Richard Howard, who was the poetry editor there, and I stayed in touch with him. And you know, I still love all my poet friends there too much to ever renounce the time I spent on that. May one day turn back to it. I'm actually on a novel right now about this same subject matter. Okay. But the Paris Review, I feel like I thought of it as kind of you know, something that could be summarized by something that Richard Howard said to me once, which is, if you go to France to study, the professors aren't treating you like your worst idea matters as much as the best student's best idea. That's me paraphrasing. What he actually said was, you know, I want the students to come up to me. I don't want to come down to them and treat them like it's a therapy session or like it's a self-help group. Yeah. And I sort of get that. There are standards and there are rigorous standards. But what I came to see is he was describing the belles lettres sensibility, and the Paris Review, just to give the nutshell history of its ties to intelligence, is is interesting because there were magazines that were created by the CIA. The flagship was Encounter in London, and they were created, funded, and curated by the CIA, with censorship being explicitly written in to the marching orders. But then there were these magazines that either came up later but were seen as friendly, or they pre-existed the CIA. Another one was The New Leader, and it was a far-left magazine, to use that sort of bogeyman term. It was a progressive magazine of the left, and then it had its awakening about Stalin and Stalin's atrocities, so it became reliably anti-communist. So what these magazines would get would be some kind of approach, and a lot of times they would be subsidized through subscriber bases or ads or both. And they would basically be told, keep doing what you're doing. In the case of The New Leader, it was interesting. It was broadsheet, like a newspaper, and they wanted it to be put into digest format. And once the editor did that, he was in deep debt, and the CIA just didn't have its act together to pay him. So I found an archive at Columbia where he was just sending them letters every month saying, hey, I'm about to go bankrupt. Can you pay me, please? Like, you guys said you were going to subsidize this move into digest format.
Just a quick question. Why did they want digest form? Why not? Because it had more cultural capital than broadsheet?
I think so. That's only speculation. But I think they wanted to curate a very aesthetically pleasing body of magazines. And I think the broadsheets maybe were associated with disposable sort of ideas, disposable writing. And it wouldn't last. And I think it would probably last longer as an object too. So you could put it on your bookshelf. Mm. And the essays were then curated as less disposable work. You know, it wasn't chasing the news cycle. It was, you know, thought through critically. Mm-hmm. So the Paris Review is actually founded as part of, I mean, the other editors supposedly didn't know this, but Peter Matheson was friends with James Baldwin in 48, 49, 50. Baldwin and Humes, another founder, were there even before Matheson. I think Matheson arrives in 1950. He's published a couple short stories in The Atlantic. He's been recruited by one of his Yale professors. And I don't know who his case officer was, but he was in counterintelligence. So he was in a chain of command that had James Angleton at the top, the counterintelligence chief.
Weirdo and extraordinaire, paranoid.
Yeah. Talk about an eccentric, paranoid personality. And whoever Matheson's case officer was, he told him the novel writing and the being a fiction writer wasn't enough for a cover. And so he floated the idea of this magazine he was talking about with a few other expats becoming part of his cover. And it was founded, they started talking about it in 51. They started debating names. It launches in 53. That's one big CIA tie in its history, and that's the one that managed to get into print in 1977. But there were several others through the Congress for Cultural Freedom and through John Train, and you know, we can get into those if you want.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned briefly that I just want to dwell on for a moment, because it was kind of a shock to me, is the way an English degree was like pre-law for law school. I mean, this was what you majored in if you were going to go into intelligence. And I had that sense of a kind of belles lettres tilt to British intelligence agencies, but not until I read about Angleton, who was, you know, sucking up to Ezra Pound and writing essays about him, and then meanwhile practicing spycraft, that I saw how much the English department at Yale, in particular, it seems, was where they recruited their spies.
Yeah, it seems like so much of the Cold War was the work of frustrated poets. If only they could have focused on their meter and verse.
A lot of frustrated artists have done a lot of damage in the world over in the 20th century, huh?
You have a certain guy
with a mustache.
One hates to go to Vienna and Berlin with that analogy. The crew, I think they learned their craft, you know, in World War II with the OSS. And, you know, it's funny because there's poets, there's also the Wall Street lawyers. And they had learned a lot from Freud. Speaking of Vienna, Freud's nephew, this guy, I think it was Edward Bernays.
You're right.
Yeah, and Stephen Kinzer, I know, was on your show, and he talks about Freud's nephew in Overthrow.
Right.
This idea of sort of marketing and branding and what becomes the sort of the Bible of Madison Avenue. That was in their DNA as much as poetry,
right,
and the importance of little magazines and big ideas. And I think they were curating themselves in their own minds. You certainly see this in Angleton's biography, as the inheritors of all the high culture. It was like, you know, we get to just take these Apollo torsos down from the shelves in European capitals and bring them to New York. Like, that was almost the sense they had of what they've inherited. And a lot of the early actions were English and American partnerships, certainly the Iran coup. And it was like the English were out of money, and they knew that the pigs in New York could pay. And were what the cost of that was is they wanted sort of a makeover, where they suddenly weren't so middle and lowbrow, and now they were highbrow.
Right. Well, and also, as John mentioned, I mean, pedigree comes into this in a huge way. All these, so many of these people, Plimpton, Matheson, I mean, one after another, they come from old money New England families. They're all very well connected. Who's the other? I can't remember his name. The guy
Aldrich,
was Aldrich. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes, the editor of Paris Review also came from like generations of old New England wealth, and you can see.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. They seem to kind of conflate a few things here. One is, I think there was definitely, genuinely, a real anxiety about the power of, the cultural power that communism and the Soviet Union had among intellectuals. But then there's also just this sort of, the American nomenclatura sees itself as the keepers of, as you say, the curators of high American culture. So they kind of conflate the two in a CIA mission, it seems like, you know.
Yeah, I think in Evan Thomas's book about the CIA, The Very Best Men, he has one of them quoted as, you know, considering themselves almost an order of knights. They are the high-minded sort of protectors of civilization. And, you know, as corny as that sounds now, especially when you contrast it with, you know, as we're speaking, there's these people talking to Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer, and it doesn't feel like culture or high-mindedness or good grammar are valued right now. But the experience of World War II, I think, solidified a lot of this. A lot of these Wall Street lawyers, Ivy League educated, blue blood, white American males, all pretty much fitting the profile there, were in the OSS, and they turned Nazis. They got them to become informers. They did propaganda. They did sabotage. And that becomes the seed for both the CIA and the sense that OSS was heroic, that the CIA had to be heroic. And the other part is exactly what you said, seeing Berlin divided into its various quarters, and the Western Allied powers would watch soldiers from their quarters going over to the Soviet section to watch films, to watch dance, to watch orchestra performances. And they thought, oh, you know what? They don't know. The Europeans don't know. If culture matters to the Europeans, then that's the case we need to make to fund it. And the CIA's secret budget became their magic bullet, because it was, you know, pre-McCarthy America. No one was really interested in funding culture. They didn't want to have a debate. And, you know, the other option would have been, for at least international culture, the State Department, which they did some test runs of abstract expressionism. It didn't work out so well. So they backed away from it rather than making the case. So that's how the Congress of Cultural Freedom, which is the cultural instrument of the CIA, was born. All of those high ideals and sort of snob appeal behind it were then weaponized by saying, like, even if our folks back home don't always get it. We need to do it because we've been to Europe and we know that the Europeans are our most important allies, and their intellectuals have left-wing tendencies. They have these high-minded cultural tendencies, and we need to make the case to them whether the rest of our government gets it or not. So they kind of did it on the sly.
Right.
That's interesting in a lot of ways. I mean, for one thing, if you look at American culture circa 1950, it's hard to avoid the saying, the general sense that American low culture was its highest point. I mean, it's hard to imagine anything finer than a Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
But it would have been impossible to make the case for that as an emblem of the superiority of American culture at the time. So you end up with poetry, an awful lot of poetry, like this Yale professor Pearson hiring Hilda Doolittle's HD's daughter. I mean, I didn't think anybody knew who Hilda Doolittle was. It was
right.
The poetry mill. And, right. And now, but in this world, poetry has this huge status. And I can see that when you imagine it as an export product rather than something intended for domestic consumption.
Yeah, I think that's right. They didn't care too much about poetry as, you know, in itself, let's say. But there were poets who were also just generally men and sometimes women of letters who were also critics, who were also public political personalities. Archibald MacLeish was one. Later on, we see Pablo Neruda being an important sort of poetry leftist ambassador. And so poetry matters in the Cold War, certainly internationally for the Americans, insofar as it can do political work or it can do power, you know, whether the phrase soft power didn't exist yet. But this is what it's all reduced to. And you see a lot of contradictions and problems start to creep in. I mean, the way I described it is kind of the best case scenario of the people who defended it and the apologists for the Congress for Cultural Freedom when it was exposed. And I tried to start there because that seems like the most generous case to make in their own terms. But what you also see comes in through organizations like the American Committee for Cultural Freedom, which precedes the Paris-based international body. And those guys were a kind of a messy American, you know, consensus of anti-communists who were on the left, right, and center. And
that was a nasty crew. I didn't know much about them before, I have to say. I, you know, that you have that scene early on where they, I mean, they're basically like organized, you know, as what you call today, like, let's say, organized anti-Russian disinformation trolls or some, or, you know, or NGOs, and they go on and they just harry anybody who gets too out of line. And but more direct and pretty horrible.
Yeah, some of the impulses seem, you know, both harmless and maybe a bit theatrical or dramatic at first, where they just go to the peace conferences around the world. They assume that they're being funded by the Soviets. You know, one thing it's good to remember is that in the late 40s and early 50s, you know, a lot of people thought we were going to end up in an all-out war with the Soviets. And, you know, that's the context of the Korean War. And against that backdrop, what you see are left-wing intellectuals actually making the case for peace at conferences that are called, you know, Peace Committee and World Peace Conferences. And the CIA and the hawks in the U.S., assuming, you know, with some evidence that those were Soviet funded, and they go and they just refute. It's wonderful. It's almost Socratic, and it's very theatrical. And some of them are just saying, well, why did you edit your novel? Just because your Soviet minders told you to. Why didn't you fight? And they're putting people in these weird positions where if the repression is as bad as they say, then they can't really give you an honest answer. And that was part of the performance. That was part of the theater. What then happens is you see all the usual McCarthyite tendencies sort of creeping into this intellectual world that is trying to claim that it's better than that.
The lists of subversives and also the list. Yeah. I didn't know that these guys made up Mary McCarthy and they made up these lists of subversives and, you know.
Yeah, one famous one was Orwell's list that he gave to Robert Conquest's Secretary Celia, I forget her last name right now. And the Congress for Cultural Freedom was doing this. They were also doing white papers. So a little bit later, they spread disinformation about Pablo Neruda being in on the attempt to murder Trotsky, which he was not. I don't think there's any evidence of that. Yeah. So the disinformation, and it starts to creep into the magazines. I just did, I just published something in Truthdig that was an expanded version of the preface for the Iran edition of Finks. And I had seen some of these articles, but I wanted to go back in light of kind of Iran's 40th anniversary since the Iranian Revolution and other things. I was looking at how often they did hard propaganda while a coup was underway that was sponsored by the U.S. or what one that had just ended. And so within a year of the Iran coup, they were spreading disinformation about it in Encounter, their flagship magazine.
So, hold on, I want to stop you here. So first of all, there's an edition of Finks that just came out in Iran?
I think it's due out this spring sometime. Yeah,
that's great. Congratulations. Cool. Yeah, you don't expect that to happen. That's okay. So you're talking about the 1953 CIA-backed British-inspired coup to overthrow the democratically elected Mossadegh, basically, and install the Shah as a totalitarian leader, right? So that's the coup you're talking about. And so right at that time, these covertly CIA-funded magazines like Encounter were publishing disinformation about Mossadegh, or?
Yep.
Okay.
And just to back up a little bit more to explain the way you are, your listeners probably know a lot about this. The center and the right seem to either not know this history in the U.S. or they don't really care. but it's really important. Iran in 1953, up until that summer, was a democratic country. Women had a lot more freedom. They could get educations. And they had an elected leader named Mossadegh. He was appointed by the Shah because the previous person from parliament who was appointed was killed. So his frenemy, Shah, the Shah, the infamous Shah, Reza Mohammed, was in a position where he had to appoint this guy who was kind of his frenemy. We overthrew him in the late summer, early fall of 53. Some of the people who worked on it, incidentally, and this comes from Francis Stoner Saunders, as so much important work on the cultural Cold War does, they worked on that simultaneously with launching Encounter.
I'm sorry, I just have to insert this here. Encounter magazine is probably the best known person that our listeners would know would be Irving Kristol, was a top person. Irving Kristol is the godfather of neoconservatism. Of course, his son, Bill Kristol, Dan Quayle's brain, the Iraq War brain, and so on. So, yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And that lineage is kind of important. I touch on it throughout the book. I don't get to, really explore it as much as I would have liked to. There's a lot of threads in any book where you can sort of foresee your next book or your next several. But Encounter was the flagship CIA magazine. It was based in London. It had distribution mostly in London, but a little bit in Europe and around the world, and certainly in Asia. It was, the shortened version of East-West Encounter. They wanted to have kind of cultural reach around the world. And even though it was CIA-funded, it was probably illegally distributed in the U.S. through the American Committee for Cultural Freedom.
Hi, Bob, you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, what I heard is a distinction, maybe I got it wrong, between something like the Paris Review and something like Encounter, in that the Paris Review was intended to have a deeper cover, as it were, right? To seem completely outside of politics. Is that right?
Yeah, the Paris Review, I think, being born in Europe, it was trying to exist alongside these a little bit more rabble-rousing official CIA magazines. It may have just been, it's always been described as the natural tendency of its founding editors, and I believe that too. It's just that those other editors didn't realize that one of them was a CIA agent who was patting them on the back and encouraging every time they said they didn't want to publish axe grinders, which was their phrase. but more at the macro level, it was one of these friendly magazines where there was some insider who had either CIA ties or CIA hawk tendencies or CIA social ties. And it wasn't funded directly by the CIA, unlike Encounter. Encounter was launched by the CIA and British intelligence. And so
was this generally known?
It was not known. It was known that it was funded through the Congress for Cultural Freedom. Right. There were some open rumors on the left that that was a CIA instrument throughout its life. That was, it was sort of discouraged or winked away if its editors who were not in the know or its writers who were not in the know mentioned this. You know, there's a lot of debate about how much people knew right. at the time.
I was kind of surprised from your book how many people did sort of openly talk about it in the 50s. Like, oh yeah, those guys are linked to the CIA. It was sort of, as you're saying, among certainly among more leftist people, it's kind of like an open secret, but not officially acknowledged, right?
Yeah, and sometimes it would probably even have been denied.
Right.
And yeah, it was also seen. I mean, I think one of the earliest critics of this, once it's exposed definitively in 67, just to jump ahead to that. Mm-hmm. Within a year of that, Christopher Lash, the great cultural critic, mm-hmm. was the one who coined the phrase the Cultural Cold War. He was the one who described their structure at places like Encounter as having this really ingenious design. Reaching out to the world would be the unwitting cultural ambassadors, the smartest of the smart, you know, the very best men. They would be cultural ambassadors through their poetry, through their writing, through their prose. They would tend not to know, and they would be discouraged from knowing unless, you know, they could get the insiders, who were the op-ed writers, the editors, the Irving Kristols, the Steven Spenders, who tended to know, mm-hmm. Although a lot of them wanted to deny it when it was exposed. Those guys were, you know, he describes them as witting and kind of, they could take a hint, and they were willing to effectively have either their hawkish tendencies monetized or their politics bribed. That's kind of...
Can we talk about the money for a moment? Because, yeah. I mean, as a fellow poet, you know, there's no money in it. And yeah. It would be really kind of a big deal if somebody was going to pay you a lot of money and you were an American poet. So were these guys getting paid a lot of money? And how did it work?
I think what you can see from some of the salaries that were listed in various histories and in the archives when you look it up, they were getting, you know, the equivalent of, you know, hundreds of thousands and millions in operating expenses per year if they were official magazines. Even some of the semi-official ones were getting big budgets. It seems like they were paying the equivalent of glossy magazine rates for,
wow.
certainly for prose. I'm not sure wow. if the rates were quite as high for poetry, alas. but those poets who were, you know, engaged in this would tend to also be prose writers, and you know, you could sell a piece to Encounter probably for close to what you could get at the New Yorker. A lot of the writers That's who would crazy. Publish in one would publish in the other. Mm-hmm. But yeah, these are important essays that are, you know, that are written mm-hmm. around deep reading, multiple books. The review essay was kind of a classic format. So that's the background of Encounter. And just to close the circle on the Shah and everything right. else that we said, within a couple of months of its founding, it's got some of the same people who have founded it who've taken part in this coup. And then within a couple of months of that, they've got one of those writers basically blaming everything that's now happening under the Shah. Because as soon as we remove the democratic leader and leave the Shah there to be our guy, we also send, the CIA sends over a naval officer to start their secret police, which became SAVAK. Mm. And that was a secret police that was created by American and British intelligence, and that it did the worst things to Iranians. And it led to, there's no question, but Stephen Kinzer is the best on this. It led to the 1979 revolution, where you end up with a theocracy as a result. They knew that the Shah was our guy. They knew that he was torturing. They knew that he was censoring. They knew that he was, you know, arresting political prisoners and sometimes disappearing them, probably. So what you get in Encounter a few months after that all goes down and is underway and the big change is happening, you get this disinformation piece. Now, those are the winking op-ed writers who knew where the money was coming from and knew what their job was. But the rest of the world would just see this as, oh, Encounter is not just an East-West Encounter, but it's a liberal-conservative Encounter. So it would look like, oh, well, that's just the conservative hawk point of view that Encounter right. publishes. They wouldn't right. know that this guy might also be a CIA contractor, which some of their writers were. They might not know that he helped plan the coup himself.
So what did he say in the? What does he say in the So basically, you have a guy from Encounter working with the CIA, then going to and helping plant some disinformation, going to Iran, helping overthrow the democratically elected, then coming back to Encounter again and saying, planning more disinformation afterwards about what did he say exactly?
Yeah, the guy in question, Christopher Montague Woodhouse, right. a very upper crusty guy.
Yes.
He worked with a lot of American intelligence people to put together Encounter and to kind of figure out its mission. He later wrote for it. I don't think he wrote directly about the coup himself, but he may well have been one of the people who said, oh, you should hire this guy Alaman, who's really great on Iran.
I see.
It ends up being a Swiss writer who writes about it. But what you see later, for instance, Brian Crozier is the guy who they sent to Latin America to cover the early bribery that they're doing in the Chilean elections. Mm. Brian Crozier was a CIA agent. He was a CIA contract worker. When he writes for Encounter, he's double dipping in CIA cash. Now, what you see later is Christopher Montague Woodhouse reviewing Crozier's book. So you see a CIA, a British intelligence spook on the inside at Encounter, reviewing a CIA paid British officer whose book about revolutions is supposed to be reputable. There's just a lot of deception within these layers of payment and secrecy, and it's not usually what you hear about Encounter. When it was exposed, you would hear, oh, we never censored, we published, everyone from Borges on the right to the best sort of leftist writers you can think of, which is true. They had a great masthead, but that was in essence part of the cover. That was part of the great writers. And what you could look for is a hypothetical percentage. How many so-called stray cultural pieces did you need before you could do the one hard propaganda piece that was disinformation filled? Was it 1 out of 10 hard propaganda pieces? Whatever it is, it's just intended to make the propaganda work better because it's disguised.
Mm-hmm. Right.
This Brian Crozier you mentioned, I forgot. So he kind of brought up Robert Moss. I don't know if you got into this story much, but Robert Moss is the guy who wrote The Spike with Arnold Borchgraf, and who kind of, they basically invented the first Russian disinformation panic back when I was a kid.
Yeah, that makes sense. I didn't know that. I'd love to know more about that. I just discovered Crozier's role because he was named in this really famous, which I went back to. I wrote about it in Finks, but when I was doing that preface, I mentioned that it was published in Truthdig last month or this month. I was reminded from John Crutzen, in one of the definitive articles exposing how this all grows. I mean, what happened in 67, I mentioned it was exposed, and round one, you see apologists saying we didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
We should be proud of our legacy. Round two, you see the revisionists kind of making their points. Round three, you don't see because it's very secret. You see it a decade later, the CIA's response to its secrecy being exposed by places like Ramparts is it just doubles down on packing the American media with agents, with infiltrators. And it's really, really sneaky, deceptive, scary, and illegal. And so Ramparts, within a couple of days of this operation going down, Operation Chaos,
right?
They had dossiers on about 55 of their writers, editors, and other associates.
Warren Hinkle. Yeah, we've talked.
Yeah,
about
legend,
this,
legendary yeah. figure. Yes. One of the heroes of the book. That just spreads, and it's exposed under a slightly different name in the 70s is Operation Mockingbird. It goes from sort of the college press, the university rags, those broadsheets that are against the Vietnam War. It spreads to other slightly more mainstream, and eventually, and maybe it was like that from the beginning, we don't know. The dots are connected sort of vaguely, but you see both Carl Bernstein in Rolling Stone in 1977 and John Crutzen in New York Times exposing it from different angles. Crutzen focuses on the international papers, you know, all the English language papers in the world capitals around the world, supposedly had one agent there who could get a story killed or get it to run if it was friendly, which is startling. And then within the US, what Bernstein focuses on is all of the major networks, all of the major newspapers, all the major magazines had these same agents who at the very least would debrief, but some who had signed secrecy agreements with the CIA as agents.
This is something that struck me when I was reading your book, because Mark mentioned The Spike. Mark and I both read The Spike in previous incarnations, and we did a show about it. It was a really important book in the early 80s, and you describe an episode which is oddly like The Spike. If I can read a bit of your book, CIA alumnus William F. Buckley was ready to skewer the craven, supposedly liberal media for not championing Train's hard-hitting expose on the KGB in the United States. The title of Buckley's column said it all, "Why Won't TV Show This Documentary?" Describing the Train Group's KGB film as the most powerful two-hour documentary on the subject of underground Soviet activity ever put together, Buckley went on to complain to readers across America that the producers can't get it shown in the United States. In other words, that's the plot line of The Spike. And of course, it did get shown and it made a lot of money, but he gets paid off both ways. He gets he and his friends get the victimhood, and then they get profit and the exposure.
Yeah, that was a column that ran in multiple papers across the U.S. And the first result, I think, was that the documentary was played in the Reagan White House to all staff. And so it had already made money. It seems like the record indicates that he had made some money because he was bragging in another the John Train, the producer, was bragging about that. John Train is another sort of way.
Yeah, can we talk about John Train?
Whenever you're ready.
He's the central figure of the book in some ways.
Yeah. So he's one of the founders. It's like there's a large group of founders of the Paris Review. I'm sorry to get off subject quickly, but it is still surprising to me that the intelligence agency cared so much about a literary journal, you know, or that it wound up being the center of so much activity or any of these journals, but anyway.
I think it was, you know, it was well described by pundits as kind of trickle down, you know, trickle down Cold War idea peddling,
right?
Trickle down culture. John Train is interesting. He's still alive. He was a founding managing editor of the Paris Review, and he's someone who crosses through a bunch of different fields. He's a finance whiz. He claims that he helped burnish Warren Buffett's early reputation with one of the things he wrote about him. He also, in addition to coming from a sort of a posh family with British roots, aristocratic British roots, he was friends with a lot of these guys. I think he was one of the Harvard ones. And maybe he came out of the Lampoon world. I checked that. Mm. Half of them were Harvard and half of them were Yale. I'm forgetting which was Train. I think Harvard. But Plimpton himself was at the Harvard Lampoon, and there was this appreciation for humor and spoof, which was actually widely distributed in the early CIA. They had these comedy writers who would come up with pranks, and they would send oversized condoms and hot air balloons over the Iron Curtain, or they would plot to, and the idea would be, you know, we're better endowed in the West, and that was just intended to be a net. Speaking of, you know, Mad Magazine, that was intended to be just sort of a psychological trick to play on them, and I think that's kind of a separate category. I'm not saying
Lansdale was big in that too. Edward Lansdale.
he would poke holes
in necks and hang them upside down
and
for fun.
Say that a vampire in the forest will get you if you join the opposition. There's a lot of this. What you see in this group, I think you can separate this from trying to make a critique of the CIA. There's this tendency towards the tall tale, towards the story that will travel just because it's glorious. And Plimpton himself was a master of that. And I think he and John Train had this friendship around that. But Train was basically a finance guy. He was an entrepreneur even when they were setting up the magazine in Paris. it seems like he was the managing editor by default because one of the previous managing editors fell so romantically in love with one of the editors, one of the writers who was associated with the magazine, that he couldn't do his job. So John Train picked up the slack. He later did a stint, I think, in the Army in the mid to late 50s, came back. And he's always in the letters, in the editorial letters, he's always the guy kind of trying to get them in shape financially, getting their spending under control, figuring out the numbers, getting the two offices, because it starts with a Paris office, it ends up with a Paris and a New York office. And you just see him behind the scenes, like doing the hard work that a lot of these glorious editorial enterprises don't have someone to do, which is just to kind of crunch the numbers. But he ends up running a mag, an ad in perpetuity that helps fund the Paris Review, which one assumes was paid for through his finance companies. But when I get around to him, I saw him as maybe one of the least iconic. I don't know. I hate to insult him. He's a very nice guy and he's very iconic, but he was often overshadowed by the Mathesons and the Plimptons of the world.
Well, was he a writer? Did Train write anything himself?
You know, at the time he helped, I think, with some of those early manifestos. There was the one about avoiding axe grinders by William Styron. Okay. And then he wrote something in that same first issue that kind of, and he claims he named the Paris Review over all these other pretentious poetry magazine names. And he, you know, he was part of the cohort and he's in a lot.
But I mean, for most people there, and I found myself doing this when I was reading your book, it's like, I'm rating these people by talent, you know, and I tend to worry more about what the really talented ones thought than the ones I don't particularly like.
So, yeah, as a writer, he's known for these finance books and he's known for a series of attempts at humor books. But he ends up having some longevity. And what you see is he's trying to push some. He's trying to push some weird ties. Their landlord in Paris seems like it was part of this family, this aristocratic family that that had something to do with the founding impulses behind Charlie Hebdo, which was a thread I never really got to explore.
Wow.
But what you see him doing going for, he's also a cousin to Claiborne Pell, I guess, a U.S. senator.
Of course.
So he's in the politics world on the side of kind of hard politics. Plimpton is too. Plimpton's dad is a U.N. ambassador under Adlai Stevenson. So these worlds were all kind of interconnected for a lot of these guys. But you see you basically see John Train kind of being a founding light of the magazine, helping fund it, coming and going, occasionally reappearing with an interview with Solzhenitsyn in the 70s or 80s. And then as the closing chapter, it was this important third or fourth tie to the CIA, because what you see John Train doing, according to his own letters, which he somewhat acknowledged, are my interviews with him got less friendly after he saw the original Salon piece that was the founding first chapter of the book. And he saw that, you know, my leftist tendencies were probably going to be appearing in the book, and he got really cold. But before that, he admitted he was kind of a conduit for this world of fighting the Cold War. He was a proud Cold Warrior, and some of these things I'm trying to point out, the slippery logic of maintaining democracy by obscuring transparency or blurring the transparency. That's what you end up with. And I think, you know, some of these guys would consider that case. And I had some frank discussions with John Train where he sort of nodded along with me when I showed him my findings about how, you know, presiding over journalism through secret payment processes was not ideal. The transparency starts to get murkier. And he would nod along with that. But what you see, I've been avoiding the subject here. He was doing television propaganda, trying to get it onto mass markets like PBS. He was trying to get it into colleges. And he was doing documentaries that would make it very clear that the threat of Soviet spying or Soviet infiltration was real. But it grows into this program where he's starting foundations where they're kind of weaponizing refugee relief. He's got embedded in the refugee organizations, he's got people with links to the covert state. That's made explicit in some of the letters I found. And what you end up with is you see these letters where they're trying to bait the Soviets in Afghanistan to commit war crimes so that their operators, their paid agents who are also at major TV networks, can get footage of these crimes. They're trying to deliver to the Soviets their own Waterloo. And at that point, that had nothing to do with the Paris Review except, you know, socially. But I just thought it was this amazing coda, because you start off with all these great ideas about we need a CIA, we need to do what we did in the OSS, and you end up with a system where we're racing the Soviets to the bottom of the human rights ladder. We're trying not to stop them, as we did with Pasternak, from committing atrocities. We're actually trying to get their atrocities to happen and to happen on camera. And it gave me the chills to read it.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that struck me about your coda is it, I don't know, maybe I'm reading this wrong, but it sounded almost as if they rethought their bets on high culture versus popular video culture. And they decided, no, we better go with the documentaries.
Also, like highbrow hearts and minds versus just raw emotional, propaganda.
Right? Yeah, I think someone like Train, who goes into the military, I think there was a perception that there was a deficit of high cultural reputational. The U.S. didn't have the reputation for high culture, so that's stage. That's stage one. It's coinciding with the hard interventions of the coups and things. Mm-hmm. And what you see, people, and I guess I fall into this too, people tend to talk about the cultural CIA as a separate category from the hard CIA, which, you know, when you look at Encounter in Iran, you know that that's not the case.
Well, also, structurally, the cultural stuff was in the same group within the structure of the CIA as the coups and the paramilitary stuff, it seems like, right?
Yeah, it's the most protected side of the CIA. So the Congress for Cultural Freedom is very highbrow, but in that same, it's now called Clandestine Services, as you know, they change their name every 5 or 10 years to make it hard for archivists and people like me. You see the Free Europe Committee creating radio stations. You see Radio Free Europe, you see the Voice of Liberation, Voice of America. So they're aware of the importance of broadcast from the beginning. I was just interested in the cultural part of it, assisting the hard coups and everything, because you do get a tendency that's not perfect, but you see people like Francis Stoner Saunders or Patrick Iber, who's doing important work in Latin America, treating this as an academic area or historical area that's not known, and therefore it needs its own treatment, which is true. But I wanted to look at the cultural Cold War next to the work of people like Stephen Kinzer, who were looking at the hard coups systematically and tear down that fake wall, because, as you said, structurally it's all happening in clandestine services. So John Train, it seems like, you know, he's a very cultured guy. He's a very intelligent guy. But this is just kind of where it looks like the Cold War took him. And the broadcast stuff was always there.
Can you talk a little bit, specifically as well about, I mean, so he wound up founding this sort of refugee aid group for the Afghan refugees from the Soviet invasion and the war that was going on in Afghanistan after the Soviet invasion in 1979. And so this was in the Pakistan border region. And eventually what they wound up doing through this aid group, correct me if I'm wrong here, is then setting up, seeing the value of getting footage with portable video cameras, which were getting a lot more portable by then. They started training Mujahideen, basically future Al-Qaeda people, how to, or their, you know, their ancestors or something, how to, first of all, how to technically do it, how to film it, and essentially encouraging them to set up Soviet atrocities, because, you know, you need the propaganda, you know what you need, and they may not be doing it when you need it, or they may not be doing what you're saying they're doing, or it may be a lot more rare than whatever the case. So you need to stage it finally to get it. So can you talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, you have it pretty much right with two small adjustments. But even to precede those two small adjustments, I mean, the lesson from Vietnam should have been, don't do it.
Right.
Don't get into a race to kill, you know, to kill your way to victory so that you can stop this fake domino theory crap. That would have been the lesson. The lesson they actually took was, well, we lost. Let's see if now we can deliver a Vietnam to the Soviets.
Right.
The backstory that you need is, there's a book called The Covert Network, which is about the weaponization of the IRC, the International Refugee Committee.
What's the name of the book again? I'm sorry.
The Covert Network.
The Covert Network. Thanks.
I'm forgetting the author's name. I probably have it right here. An author named Chester, Eric Thomas Chester. It's really important. It shows that the IRC, as noble as their work is today, they always had a bit of a hard power tie. The work starts with, you know, probably even before World War II, helping Jews get out of Europe, which is crucial. But alongside that, after World War II, they always have some kind of tie on the board to the CIA, and they're often working in tandem with the CIA so that they can debrief, you know, the smarter student refugees from a given crisis area can be debriefed. They might be interviewed about, you know, their willingness to go back over the border as a spy. So it's the weaponization of refugees that's one key backstory that explains John Train's work. The other is, again, that Mockingbird story by Carl Bernstein. Real media people were recruited. So it wasn't handheld, you know, home videos that they were looking to make. They had professional major network cameramen over there, and they talk about it. They black out in the letters to each other. They black out the names of those cameramen who are friendly CIA covert spies who are also at some major network. And you know, you get real names from Carl Bernstein. The article's up on his website, and everyone should read it, along with the John Crutzen article in the Times, which you can also see in their archives. Anyway, those two key pieces of information explain exactly what Train was doing. Train was basically making a nonprofit building off of his refugee relief work. He said in one letter, he said, you know, you can't subvert the refugee effort. And I don't think we should mind if former leftists are doing work with us, because sometimes the former leftists are the most hawkish, you know, among us. And you just can't subvert refugees. It always works. It's always working as propaganda, but it always does this work for us. So he's doing legitimate refugee relief work. He's funding schools and things. And what you see is this this infamous incident where the CIA is behind these textbooks that are explaining jihad, because they want jihad against the Soviets. And that's all paid for by the U.S. taxpayer.
Textbooks that are distributed to Afghan refugees in Pakistan, right?
Yeah, they're working in religious schools.
Right.
And
radicalizing them. I mean, they're radicalizing the youth, essentially.
The weaponization of jihad is a very underreported part of this.
Brzezinski, at least, was one of the stranger quotes of the late Cold War, where Brzezinski said, of course we did that. What are a few angry Arabs compared to the liberation of Central Europe? I think then someone told him, shut up.
That was one of my, I don't like the phrase conspiracy, but one of the hypotheticals that I was looking into to see if I could prove it. There was a presence in Afghanistan before we lured the Soviets in. And I say we lured decidedly, because some officials have revised that on their own. People like Steve Cole don't accept those quotes where they said, you know, we had a presence there before the Soviets came in. But that's a very limited look. They're talking about 1979.
Right.
I'm talking about going back to the 60s. We were funding groups in the universities and things like that. And the Soviets probably figured that out, whether this, you know, this debatable trigger was important or not to them. So Train's main project in Afghanistan is refugee relief in Pakistan, but then he sees TV networks from Italy kind of weaponizing the footage of the war, and he decides to start a nonprofit and to feel out some of his friends about joining it. You see him actually doing that. You see him making documentaries, and eventually he's trying to get these distributed on colleges. You know, some of the documentaries are not directly from Afghanistan, but he's also sort of setting up a network where the footage, he says there must be no delays in getting this footage to mainstream networks.
Right. And they do, right? I mean, a lot of this stuff then is rebroadcast in European and American network news without proper disclosed attribution, right?
Yeah. You see me tracing so many threads that that would, if I was as obsessive as I sometimes like to be, I would have tried to trace, I would have tried to make friends with Train again and kind of figure out what got played.
Right.
This particular train of weaponizing, a particular trend of weaponizing specifically Salafi or Wahhabi Sunni Islam is something that goes back and can be documented to the late days of the British Empire. I mean, Mark Curtis has a wonderful book, Secret Affairs, Britain's Collusion with Radical Islam. And then there's, in so many ways, there's the handoff between the British intelligence services to the American intelligence services, roughly in the late 1940s, with a lot of tips on how to do this. And then comes the very literal weaponization of radical Salafi and Wahhabi hostility to Arab leftists, Arab nationalists, pan-Arabists, who are more or less wiped out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that can be documented across a wide range of countries.
Yeah, Robert Dreyfus has a good book on that. And one of the phrases that they used in the 60s, I think actually late 70s, early 80s, was the Ark of Islam. They knew that there were a lot of Muslims in the, the Soviet republics sort of on the perimeter, and they wanted to weaponize that. And one interesting case of kind of intellectual blowback, you know, some of the people I've read around in the cultural Cold War and read through it and learned a lot from have defended the CIA on the basis of their being on both sides of a given fight. and I don't think that exonerates them. I think that just means that they're, you know, sort of cynical pragmatists. But in the case of the 1979 Iranian Revolution, there were some inside the CIA who said, you know, as tragic as this may seem to the outside and for the families of people who are being kidnapped right now, this is great. Like, we should use this. We should try to export this to the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, it was already that was already happening. You know, that idea was already there of weaponizing jihad. And we know that grows, and that leads to some awful confusion about who we should support and given civil wars and given disputes and things.
Before we leave this train of thought, sorry for the bad pun, I want to play for you this kind of famous, briefly kind of shock famous audio recording. This is from a few years, I think this is from the summer of 2016. And it's a leaked audio of, this is in CNN and New York Times, of John Kerry, when he was Secretary of State, talking with some representatives of the Syrian opposition as the war was starting to look, you know, pretty bad at this point. And I'm just going to play a small part here so you can hear it, but he basically tells them, try and get as much video of Russian atrocities as you can. it's at this part in the conversation where one of the persons from the opposition, this is people from, I think, like different parts of the opposition, including White Helmets, is saying that, you know, we don't see the Russians as being good partners, and they're, she's saying that they're bombing us and so on. So you're going to start to hear her speaking. I'll cut in the middle of her, and then Kerry's response and talking about make sure you get video of this. Okay, so here I'll play.
As a partner of the regime in bombing Syrians, Syrian civilians, marketplaces, even our own teams, the Syria civil defense teams, we've documented since the start of the Russian intervention in Syria from day one until February of this year, more than 17 of our Syria civil defense personnel have been killed by Russian strikes.
Do you have any videos of the airplanes that these strikes?
Have you got a boss in the flight off?
I'm Can we get, I mean, I've been looking for videos for ages. I've been asking for them.
There's more of that. I just wanted to play a small clip, mm-hmm. you know, just so you can yeah. hear it with your own ears. And then there's more where he's talking about how, you know, you should really work on getting videos of this. It just brought, that's why, how I first came to your book, actually. It was like, this, there has to be a history to this, you know, and you found it. Yeah,
it's a small thread in the book, and it was one of those, you know, bitterly satisfying moments where you're like, wow, I didn't think I was going to be able to sustain the Paris Review's ties this far into the book. You know, they just kept cropping up.
It's amazing.
It was amazing. But yeah, what you're seeing there, I mean, it would be nice if we had a Democratic Party that could hammer the Republicans for their incoherence in terms of, you know, how important the war on terror was against his so-called Islamic Jihad versus these other boogeymen in places like Russia, and what our frenemy status is supposed to be with China. But since the Democrats have a similar incoherence, it's really hard to carve out a foreign policy. And I think my sense of statements like that, I mean, yeah, if you've got a policy and you want to back it and you can get images of your enemies doing something awful, well, if that's sort of done honestly, then that is making the case, and that's important. We all have to make our case. But there, at least as I saw it in some of these archives, there was a cynical side to it where it wasn't just, let's see videos of something that we know is going on, but it was like, let's create an incident. They actually said, let's have a skirmish by our friends, and they'll go across, they'll rush across the border and try to spur a counterattack that we can get on film.
Was it Hekmatyar? I'm trying to remember now.
Yes.
It's the worst of the worst.
Yeah, and some of his worst atrocities, you know, happened after the Soviets fled, to be fair to our team, so-called. He turned out to be not a human rights respecter and an early supporter of ISIS, and he was our man in Afghanistan. He was one of the ones that the Afghanistan Relief Committee was sort of bragging about having on as an advisor and friend.
They loved him in the Reagan years. I remember that very well. I mean, he was a nasty one going back to his student days, wasn't he? Setting women on fire at the university and that sort of thing.
He was killing students by way of expressing his political viewpoint on campus.
I mean, like Iran, there was a very liberal urban culture, a very modern urban culture in Afghanistan, and the various interventions from, you know, the late 70s to now have virtually destroyed most of what was there. You'd see, not that young women dressing in Western clothes is the goal of any culture, but it was seen as a part of how, you know, feminist and modern those cities were. Of course, the villages were always smaller and conservative, but there's some claims that weaponized Islam comes with all these wars, and you can imagine that being the case.
Yeah, so let's get back to some important parts of the book, and then we've kept you on a long time, so I want to get to sort of a couple of really key moments. I know, John, you want to talk about Lowell and Latin America, and I wanted if you could also talk briefly about the Zhivago story, the Pasternak story. It's a really horrible story, I have to say. I'm not a huge fan of that novel in particular. I know his poetry is supposed to be great. I don't know his poetry as well. But talk about weaponizing things. I mean, Pasternak was, I mean, he was in an obviously incredibly difficult situation, always being a prominent artist, writer, throughout the Stalin period, and he survived it. You know, he's pretty lucky too. So he learned how to be cautious and just stick his neck out just enough to be also a talented, I mean, he obviously had a lot of talent, a great writer, but how to protect himself too. And really at some point, well, it was kind of amazing also, I'd forgotten Fertinelli, his role.
Feltrinelli.
Yeah, he comes in. And anyway, the whole story about publishing Dr. Zhivago wound up it wound up killing him, essentially, and we seem to have not cared. And I think, I don't know if you were explicitly making this analogy, I maybe you were, but it really does sort of remind of the way we use a lot of these emigres, these anti-communist emigres, and just kind of drop them behind the Iron Curtain or into Albania, and they all wound up just getting mowed down, and we didn't seem to really care that much about that. But anyway, can you tell the Pasternak story and, you know,
how Pasternak and you also mentioned the Lowell thing, but those were kind of twin things, because the Lowell incident was a response to the other Stalinist poet, Pablo Neruda. And you can call, no one, and a lot of people will probably come at me for saying this, but Pasternak said, even much later in his life, when he was in fact an anti-Stalinist, that for much of his career he was a sincere writer trying to write in the context of his times, and he wrote his own kind of odes to Stalin. And when Stalin died, he was expected to sign a letter, a group kind of condolence letter, to Stalin's family or whoever was remaining in the party. He went beyond that and wrote his own letter to Stalin, and no one quite understood that, because his novel was, it's hard to gauge how good it is, because it was immediately weaponized by the West.
Right.
And so both Neruda and Pasternak are also an example of the weaponization of the Nobel Prize. And
right.
The interesting dance that the committee had to do, picking a Western writer versus a communist writer. And sometimes in the middle, it would be a so-called, you know, Soviet or Russian or communist geographical writer who's being weaponized by the West as a dissident. I think Pasternak was up for the Nobel before he wrote a novel in 1946. I think there was an Oxford Don who nominated him. His poetry is probably, if not for the Cold War, the most important aspect of his literary legacy. But what happened in a nutshell was the West knew that this novel was happening. He conscripted a left-wing publisher in Italy who was quasi-communist, but not, you know, maybe more in the democratic socialist tradition. He trusted him for whatever reason, and that main publisher, into Italian first, would then preside over all the translations. And he was the unique person entrusted with this. The CIA wanted to subvert that as quickly as it could, and they started working on getting the Russian original printed inside Russia, which was a deadly thing to do. Mm-hmm. As taught to history by Pasternak's own neighbor, a guy called Boris Pilniak,
right,
who published in the West first and was shot in the head. Later, it happens during the mid-60s, two writers were imprisoned for publishing in the West first. So there's a long tradition of the Soviets assuming that there's a propagandistic hand to
these publications. Is that Sinyavsky, or who was?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Sinyavsky, yeah, okay.
Daniel and Zabrowski. Right. You see the CIA trying to get in on this, and you know, he had very specific orders. He said no American hand or intelligence hand can be involved in any future hypothetical potential Russian version. And what the West tried to do through the CIA and British intelligence, they smuggled out a copy of the Russian. They kind of fucked it up by printing his name wrong. They, in publishing, it's called a crash printing if you're rushing something to press. They tried to distribute it through the Vatican at the World's Fair in, I think, Belgium, if I remember correctly. This chapter I haven't gone back to in a while. And then from there, it's going to get smuggled in a pocket-sized edition. This program of the CIA's actually was deemed so successful that they multiplied it. They made it permanent, and they made they made Samizdat into an official CIA operation. So it's no longer kind of innocent dissidents doing this. This is another example of the weaponization of human rights, which you see later with refugees.
Right.
And I think, you know, the lesson we should take from what happened was, you know, a dissident will tell you what they want and what they're levels of risk are, and you should listen to them.
Right.
And the West was not doing that. Other books have made this look kind of like a heroic CIA thing. I don't know how these tendencies keep creeping in. The first person I saw to criticize it, again, I go back to her again and again, Frances Stoner Saunders. She's amazing.
Yeah.
And she, this was not part of her Cultural Cold War book. This was a response, I think, to a Michael Scammell piece in the London Review or the New York Review. And what she said was that he was sick when they did this. He was suffering from, you know, aftermath of a heart attack. And that's all well and fine, and I would have left it alone, except you see the Paris Review creep into the story too. Right when the Nobel scandal happens, you know, it plays itself out in the Times in October, I think, of 58, and you see letters from George Plimpton saying, hey, let's do a forum in the Paris Review, sort of left and, you know, dove and hawks together talking about this Pasternak affair. They weren't deadline publishers, so it takes them a while to do it. And what they end up with is a pretty bad Pasternak interview a couple months before he dies, after the Pasternak affair, so-called, is nearly totally settled. But what he wanted to do was to basically be left alone,
right,
and to finish this play that he was working on. The Paris Review is not doing something terribly egregious, but what you see them doing with the Pasternak affair is kind of relevance chasing. They're aware that literature has become weaponized elsewhere. They're aware that they have ties to that group. And what you see Plimpton doing on the record for one of the first times is saying, we can get the Congress for Cultural Freedom to pay for this,
right,
which was a, you know, one of the first letters I found with the ties between the Paris Review and the Congress for Cultural Freedom. So before that, it was just Matheson who was reported as the tied in CIA. Mm-hmm. Well, Plimpton and Nelson Aldrich. And what Plimpton does is, in addition to syndicating all of these interviews out to the official CIA magazines, he also shares a staffer with the CIA who would be vetted in Paris or New York. The CIA would pay half the salary and the Paris Review would pay the other half. And that's where, you know, you see Nelson Aldrich graduate from the Paris Review into the CIA's Congress for Cultural Freedom pretty clearly, wittingly, he told me. You see a really important writer, Francis Fitzgerald, who wrote a really important book against the Vietnam War, go through that same trajectory. Her dad happened
fire
to
in
be...
the, fire in the leg, that was her.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I always try to stipulate that, you know, she came out on the right side of things, but she shows that the Paris Review was kind of a de facto recruiter for the Congress for Cultural Freedom through its internship program. And there was probably one poet who went through that, who was also alive, Frederick Seidel, and maybe a few others that I couldn't document. But at least three people went from a Paris Review internship into the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which is a CIA front, through, you know, on Plimpton's watch, not having anything to do with Matheson.
Yeah. James Baldwin comes off really well in your book. Very impressive.
Yeah.
And his whole trajectory too.
And you see through him how
the CIA did effectively censor, I mean, through him and some others. They tried to, the Cold War.
Yeah, that patronizing lecture he gets from Stein, like, it's not like you, Jimmy.
You're not up to par.
Not Jimmy I want to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was another eureka moment, because you see someone who had been in the American Committee on the CIA payroll there. Much later, he's trying to weaponize Che Guevara's diaries for, you know, the interventionists in his own publishing house. And in between that, he's trying to work on this kind of anti-communist series for, I think, Beacon Press, who do also great work today.
Right.
And you see him in the editorial letters, not just saying, you know, this is too anti-American, you shouldn't waver, you shouldn't do this I hate both sides thing, you should come down. What we do is not the same. And so it's the moral equivalence argument that this guy Stein is making. I think Stein might even still be alive too. He was when I started the book, at least. But in the next letter, or in maybe one of those same letters, he also says, look, if you get this right, we will buy this up in quantity, because I know how to make the government do that. Mm. And he was talking about... he was talking about not U.S. aid, but USIA, information.
To be
agency.
Distributed abroad as a proof of
what he would do is he would get these books distributed in embassies and in cultural centers that were funded by our embassies. So it was like you could sell 1,000, I don't know how many, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 at once. You could have kind of a pathway to a bestseller. And I think that is also a legacy of this period, the Congress for Cultural Freedom. You see the infiltration of book publishing. You don't know who's got what agenda, who's paying them a little extra money, who's signed a secrecy agreement. That's also in the Crudson article in the Times. It's really astonishing stuff, and but people tend not to know too much about it.
I just have to read this. You quote what Stein writes to Baldwin here, because basically Baldwin had written up something that made them all very nervous. It had to do with, they were generally nervous at that time about the problem, the sort of PR problem that American racism and segregation presented to the rest of the world. They saw it mostly as a PR problem. Anyway, so Baldwin writes some really impressive stuff. And then here's what Stein writes. I just feel like I've seen this criticism. I've dealt with this going back many years as a writer, you know, and then so it kind of just gives you a feeling in the pit of your stomach. But he writes here, Princess and Powers is not par, Stein wrote, especially the long beginning. It reads too much like a working paper for a piece rather than the piece itself. The writing is not as uniformly good as I've come to expect of you. Neither is the thinking. And then he starts to get into what he really means, what really bothers him, which is what they now today call whataboutism. He says, Russia and America are not battling for the domination of the world. That's an inaccuracy. And all I'm quarreling with here is inaccuracy.
I remember that statement. It seemed very odd to me at the time, and that's the major premise of the Cold War. They are indeed contending for supremacy. So I don't know, Joel, what did he mean there?
Well, yeah, I think he's making this argument that seemed to work on a lot of people to stifle any questioning of the American interventionist mindset. His thinking is, we've never had gulags, so if we do some tricky things to fight gulags, it's not fighting fire with fire. We never got to gulags, and that's that's the logic of moral equivalence.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
And my sense of that is that it's a fake argument because it's static. What had happened in the 30s was problematic, but you have something that's effectively approaching gulags in Vietnam in the 60s and 70s, and there's a death count that's being asked for to prove that we're anti-communist, to prove that we can stop the domino theory. You end up with 6 million dead civilians, effectively. And so what I look at instead of moral equivalence is a process argument. What kind of arguments, what kind of rhetoric is going to elevate our democratic tendencies versus subordinate or overturn them? And I think the problem with the moral equivalence argument is we let the bar be set at the bottom rather than at the top. We should be comparing ourselves to countries that do not commit any human rights atrocities. That's my line. We have a higher standard.
But and you see it today, right, with the whataboutism. And any time, I mean, it's just used to stifle, as you're saying. It's just basically used to stifle honest debate. Like, I don't want to hear what you have to say. I'm going to scold. And you can't respond, because if you do, that makes you a Kremlin puppet. It's really crude, but somehow it seems to work with people. I don't know. I mean,
that rhetoric is, I guess, structurally a lot like what propaganda is. John Kerry saying, do you have videos, is another way of saying, I can get this into the news cycle. Yeah. And that's what we all want. We want our issues in the news cycle. And you know, sometimes this is the other problem, the other side of moral equivalence is it's an argument about intentions. And if my country is doing things against its own principles as opposed to intentions, because we can always tell ourselves that the other guy is so evil, you know, the argument of intentions is another one that's a slippery slope. It leads, you know, every dictator in the world has had in his own mind the best intentions. Mm. So moral equivalence arguments are bogus. Intentions-based arguments are bogus, and they don't fly in international law either. We should be looking at arguments that help us point back to our principles, even the ones we had to refight a few times. I think the other funny thing, by the way, about that Baldwin quote is he ends up talking about not Robeson, but maybe Du Bois as having a case of VD because...
Right.
What do you do if you have an eight-year-old who keeps going down into town and coming back cut up or with a case of VD?
You have the whole thing. You have like the moral equivalence argument put together with this paternalism.
It's really.
But the wonderful thing about Baldwin compared to a lot of the other writers that you described is that he had this ferocious talent.
Yes.
That that perhaps was doubly alienated because he's not only African American, but he's also gay. And even among people who consider themselves progressive in this era, slurs on gay people were just the norm.
Yeah.
So he had nowhere to go. And
yeah.
he was going to knuckle under very easily.
Yeah, I didn't want the book to be too grim. So Baldwin was one of my heroes, and he's heroic in the beginning because he's starting to subvert the CIA kind of propaganda, highbrow propaganda. He's writing Princes and Powers, the thing he's being criticized for in Encounter. Mm-hmm. So he's covering supposedly Soviet infiltrated conference for a certainly CIA infiltrated magazine. And later on, he starts to get grants from this milieu, and he starts to say, you know, I wasn't really all that impressed with their liberalism. They were just giving me stuff to prove how liberal they were. So he's sort of questioning, even as he's going through it, he's questioning the sincerity, and he's building out his chops as an essayist. And he was one hero. Michelle Ray does a heroic piece exposing the CIA's assassination of Che in real time. Others, you know, Bernstein, Crudson, and you know, Doc Humes is one of the kind
yeah,
of
yeah, what an interesting character.
He's certainly an eccentric guy, and his daughter got to what he wanted the Paris Review to do, which was to admit their CIA ties. She, you know, he didn't get that in his lifetime. The book starts with his letter to Plimpton and Matheson saying, "Look, let's clear the record, and then we're safe. You know, then we can go on about our business." And those guys just thought it was too risky. They ignored him. So in the 90s, she starts her film to kind of clear her dad's name as just the eccentric. I mean, he was a novelist. He was a wonderful mind. And he
and
had
a total
those
paranoid,
principles.
Right? I mean,
yeah, he became paranoid.
But he was right.
Yeah. Some of this is like what the CIA and the Cold War do to people with mental disorders. And he seems to have had something not quite manic depressive, but
well, you describe Hemingway's reputation before his death for paranoia because he kept seeing FBI agents everywhere, and as it turned out, there were FBI agents everywhere.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's kind of one of the points of your book, like you know, the paranoics were right in the most extreme way. Like the CIA is in everything; they're in Jackson Pollock paintings and Rothko, and it's crazy.
But before we close, we kept it a long time. Watch this clever segue I do here. another thing that keeps the book from being too grim is the description of Robert Lowell's visit to Latin America as a glittering sample of American cultural brilliance. I don't care. That is hilarious.
Yeah. That
unites so many things here. He's New England, blue blood, Ivy League, English department, and there he is down in Buenos Aires, where I am now, trying to climb every equestrian statue he can find in the city. No kidding. Trying to climb every equestrian statue he can find in the city and get photographed up there. And there are a lot of equestrian statues in this city, let me tell you.
That was all sort of spurred by Neruda. Neruda was this magnificent poet, leftist, man of letters and politics, whose popularity in Latin America precedes his popularity around the world. And Lowell was sent to say that we have these elegant belles lettres poets, Anglo poets in the U.S., and they win Pulitzer prizes. And you know, we sent him. It was a bit of a farcical episode, not just because he had manic depressive tendencies and alcoholism, but because he didn't know anything about Latin American poetry. And he gets there and he's safe for a little while because he's traveling with his wife and daughter. And as soon as they leave, he just starts in on the martinis while waiting for lunch. And one thing was he was buying, apparently he was just, there's an element maybe of like he didn't really feel comfortable with what he was doing. So he was buying his friends leather jackets and things. He ends up going to a left-wing party where survivors of the Spanish Civil War, friends of Hemingway's and Neruda's are present. He's arm wrestling with one when his minder finds him in this manic phase after all the equestrian statues, and they get him into a straitjacket. They lure him out into the hallway with a beautiful woman. They put him in a straitjacket. The thing, you know, the, there's images for the cultural Cold War, and one is this Wurlitzer, this instrument that plays during silent films. This was my transcendent image of the cultural Cold War. You have his minder, Keith Botsford, the guy who says that the magazines in Latin America were Fink magazines, who ends up in the, you know, in the sanitarium with I think it's called the Clinic of Bethlehem with Lowell, and Lowell is just asking him to whistle these old Western tunes, these Bach concertos, and they're sitting there whistling till their mouths are dry, and this seems to be the only thing that calms Lowell down. And to me, it really
is hilarious.
That's the cultural Cold War.
You got to read this book just for that discussion. And on that happy note, we should probably.
I love that.
Go.
That's great. I love the idea of Lowell then, you know, going out to the balcony of his sanatorium there and saying, "Now you see everyone? America can be highbrow too." You know?
There was a moment probably at some apocryphal poetry reading where it was Lowell talking about spending 3 years writing Skunk Hour and reading this grim confessional thing, and then Frank O'Hara bopping up and saying, "Hi, everybody, I wrote this on the ferry coming over, and I have always been an O'Hara man." And Lowell in Latin America makes me more of an O'Hara fan than ever.
All right, great. Yeah, let's go to end it off on a light note, because it's really worth reading. I recommend, I think our subscribers, they are interested in a lot of the topics that you cover here, propaganda, CIA, soft power, because it seems even more so in a way since the end of the Cold War that this stuff seems to have cropped up again as influencing all kinds of stuff in all the wars that we're dealing with, humanitarian wars, and people want to know about it, you know, they want to know where it comes from, how it works. And your book does a great job because you were able to kind of get into the archives, do a lot of great, really important research, and show how it worked at least the first time around in the early days, up through the 80s. So really appreciate it. I highly recommend your book, Joel Whitney's book, Finks. Thanks again for joining us. And
thank you, guys. Great pleasure to talk to you.
Great. Thanks. All right. We'll be back after a music break. Bye-bye. Okay, those were some cool tunes by our sound man, Brendan Anderegg. And just wrapping up our, that was a great interview with Joel Whitney, author of Finks. I highly recommend, again, that anybody who's interested in CIA, soft power, propaganda, and the like, that you get this book. It's a really
well,
good
read. Well, we didn't even get to one of the worst crimes committed by the Paris Review Group, which I found out about when I started researching this. Terry Southern, one of the hippie era authors who formed part of the Paris Review Group, later went into doing porn scripts and wrote a script for a porn film called Randy. You know, clever, original, mm-hmm. and stuff. And as if that weren't bad enough, he needed to use a pseudonym for his work in the film. And the pseudonym he picked, and this will earn him many, many eons in purgatory, was Norwood Pratt.
Ah! No!
Yes.
No, 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 no. Wow.
That does not. No.
So for the uninitiated, Norwood Pratt is the protagonist of Charles Portis's, I think it's his first novel, right? Norwood.
Yep.
And it's such a great novel. I guess you'd say it's his lightest novel, but it's just, I don't know. I love it every time.
That's the only one you could call almost happy.
Yeah.
Before he finally shook the dust of the United States from his sandals once and for all.
I don't know. I guess the best that you could say for Terry Southern is he at least knew who was talented. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Because it is kind of...
Maybe it was some kind of homage, as they say, in yeah. The Paris Review. But we do not do that kind of homage.
No, no, no. It's it might also be an anxiety of influence. If
yes.
we want to get Bloomian on this. Yeah, because, I mean, that's one of the things. You talked about how you sort of thumb through this book and look for, well, where was the talent in all of this? And the talent wasn't, the real talent wasn't there. I mean, I guess you could say
Roth and Baldwin, but drop after that.
Yeah. And the really great ones, at least the ones we love, you know, Charles Portis, not there, Philip K. Dick, Le Guin, all these other ones. Yeah, they're not involved in it. But I couldn't help but thinking over and over too that, it was sort of like, in that post-war era, there really is a defined nomenclatura, like a kind of American elite Cold War nomenclatura, or I don't know, just sort of an elite class of families, and this is one of their playthings, and it's kind of the same thing with the Soviet nomenclatura, and you're starting to see it again reemerge in the Putin nomenclatura. I mean, they have these kind of cushy jobs in culture.
The Paris Review Group, well, they're all men to begin with.
Yeah.
And they're all white men, and they're all rich white men, mostly from the Northeast. And they're about a head taller than everybody else in that era. And they're all thin and fit. It's kind of eerie.
Yeah. A bunch of, like, fit rowing team lacrosse player types or something, you know?
Yes, they're the rowing team.
there were a couple other things I thought. Like, one was, I forgot to say this to Joel. If you're listening to this, though, maybe you might respond to this. But when they talked about how they set up the Paris Review explicitly to be non-political, which, of course, obviously is its own political thing, which he also demonstrates, I kept thinking about, I think it was 2004, I looked it back up. It was a big story briefly in Moscow. A new magazine was started up. So the Putin era had kind of solidified at this point, the new Putin era. And there was like this kind of new confidence, new bourgeoisie. A lot of money was starting to be generated. And Putin kind of solidified his control. And after taking down Khodorkovsky, so the Yeltsin era at that point was definitely behind him. And then a new magazine appeared, and it was called Novy Ochevidets, which means new eyewitness or new observer. And it billed itself. It was a carbon copy of The New Yorker, from the cartoons and the cover, mm-hmm. the font, everything, and the kind of highbrow, very intentional attempt at being an urban highbrow magazine or high middlebrow. But they said, we're basically The New Yorker, but without the politics. And
wow.
It's so interesting that to me that, you know, highbrow culture to highbrow soft power culture, I guess you'd call it, because it all this stuff is eventually, you know, ultimately is intended to be soft power. In the Putin era, under a former KGB spy, it has the same idea of what a magazine should be like as what the CIA did. I mean, you know, yeah. as they say in all the kind of the action films or Austin Powers, you and me, we're not that different after all, are we? So, anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And the New Yorker manages it too, because I think if you translated that slogan to New Yorker subscribers, they'd say, what politics?
Well, I mean, but the New Yorker, at least at this particular time when it came out, 2004, was when Seymour Hersh was writing for them. And it was like 3 or 4 months after his bombshell stories on Abu Ghraib. And so the New Yorker kind of goes in phases. I mean, to the extent that it's political now, it's your standard anti-Trump and anti-Russia stuff. But right. back then, there was that period briefly where it was, well, because they had Hersh, and that's why Hersh right. was eventually pushed out by Remnick. They didn't like what he was saying in the Obama era, and so it's kind of liberal CIA, you know.
I can't keep up with you Americans. All right. Okay.
Yeah. So so anyway, so that's that. Great interview. Thanks again. Now let's briefly move on to, well, the biggest story of the last few days, which is...
Yeah, which is the Kashmir border, India-Pakistan. I think we spoke briefly in the last show about the attack by a suicide bomber on a column of Indian security police near Srinagar in Kashmir, 44 dead, 300 kilograms of explosives in a Hyundai SUV, oddly enough, rammed into this big convoy. Very lethal attack, the kind of thing that makes people on the home front very angry, makes them demand action, and often makes the demand so urgent that the action doesn't always work out as intended. And that seems to be what's happened. On February 26th, after some gun battles rounding up the usual suspects within Kashmir, India bombed sites inside Pakistan, and probably with good reason, in the sense that Pakistan's security state does support Jaish-e-Mohammed, Mohammed's army, the Kashmiri group that carried out the suicide attack. That's pretty much an open secret. But an attack like that then riles up the domestic audience inside Pakistan, and they demand action too. And it's not clear what happened, but somehow India today, and we're recording on February 27th, 2019, India today lost 2 fighter jets inside Pakistan, and there's footage of one of the pilots being paraded around and already talking to Pakistani media. So this is not one of those fake stories that you generally hear in the first days of combat. They did lose jets. There's photos of wreckage and all that. One of the things that struck me about it is, at least one of the jets that went down is a MiG-21. Mm-hmm. The MiG-21 is more than a half century old. Now, India supposedly has Suhoi 30s and MiG-29s, and it seemed a little odd, though I don't have any definite information right now, it seemed a little odd that you'd send a MiG-21, a plane much older than most of the people who are listening to this broadcast, into what you had to know was a very heavily defended environment across the border. And I asked on social media, anybody who knows the Indian Air Force, can you explain what's going on? And one subscriber from India said what he'd heard was that there was an attack by Pakistani F-16s. They scrambled the nearest fighter jets in the Indian base to respond. Those happened to be MiG-21s. Basically, they were tricked across the border and then blasted. I don't know if that's true, but it would at least explain why this was a MiG-21. That story also shows a really important thing here that I think a lot of people don't fully realize. Pakistan is an American military client on a gigantic scale. These were F-16s, a very, very good American plane. India does not, as far as I know, have any American fighter jets at all. They have mostly Russian and a few European, including the Dassault Mirage 2000. If there's an air duel between India and Pakistan, you will see the American hardware on the Pakistani side. And not just the hardware either. We talked last time about how there are some scary implications of what's going on the border there now. It looks as if Pakistan has been enlisted as part of a conspiracy against Iran to open up an Eastern Front against Iran. And my best guess is the attack on Kashmir is just something that the Pakistani security state has always wanted to do anyway. Mm-hmm. And now they have a green light to do that, as long as they attack Iran, which they have been doing. And I mean, every time this happens, you'll get people saying the world is about to end. As far as I know, the world is not about to end. These are states which have a long history of modulated conflict, and they can ramp it up like one popsicle stick at a time until it's like 30 meters in the air. I don't think the next step is nukes in any way, but it is getting a little hairy.
Yeah, it's dangerous, but I agree that I think, you know, when you say it's dangerous, apparently somebody pointed out this is the first time that two nuclear powers have launched airstrikes on each other in each other's territory. So, you know, these things make it sound like, well, that must mean we are 1 second from midnight. And that's so that's a little absurd. But that said, it is scary and dangerous. You know, obviously it's actually getting surprisingly.
And they both have Big Macs, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So this can't be happening.
Right. I found here some articles from, I think this is the Indian press. One of them is about why, so the headline is why the IAF picked the MiG-21s to take on Pakistani F-16s. And here it says, basically what it says is, I want to read a little bit because it's kind of interesting. Many question, I mean, apparently a lot of Indian social media is asking this too, why the MiG-21 was used to engage the F-16s. After all, it was first inducted into the IAF 56 years ago. In 1963, and has picked up the nickname the Flying Coffin due to a spate of crashes in the last couple of decades. But apparently, so they were on alert ever since the Pulwama terror attack, the Kashmir suicide bombing. It says here Tuesday night they had a mix. The Indian Air Force had a mix of Sukhoi 30s, which are good jets, MiG 29s, which are also pretty good. And they were on duty all through the night in this particular area. And it seems like the MiG-21s were just at sort of morning duty in this particular area. And I guess they had made the totally wrong calculation, or probably more likely that Pakistan had some great intelligence, that the MiG-21s were just supposed to fill in when the least possible time of an attack was going to happen. They came in right at that time and bombed, and then, yeah, it seems like they might have even lured them over the border where they got taken out.
Drew them over the border.
Yeah.
That something similar happened with a Russian plane and Israeli fighters in Syria recently.
Right. Another kind of interesting bit here, I didn't know this, that so for the actual attack, that was a couple of days ago, with the Mirage 200s. They used, it says here, that, so the Balakot strike lasted 21 minutes. That's the strike inside Pakistan. And they used 1,000-kilogram Israeli bombs. India used Israeli bombs fed with GPS coordinates. But I do know that when Modi came to power, he made sort of normalizing relations or warming relations with Israel one of his kind of planks, and the Israelis really liked him. The Israelis, Netanyahu, who now has Netanyahu just officially brought in the Kahanite party, I mean, which is, I think it's deemed a terror group in most countries in the world.
Yeah, it was pretty surprising. Even Likudniks were going, well, hold on here.
I mean, it's like the DUP, but even worse, I guess. You know? Imagine that. So here it says, the top defense sources say that the five Mirage 2000s So they bombed with five Mirage 2000s, backed up by more fighter aircraft of the same kind. So backed up by Mirage 2000 fighters, along with a number of Sukhoi 30 MKIs, a mid-air refueler, and two AWACS planes. And the strike lasted for 21 minutes. And apparently they used the Mirages because they were the best suited to fire these Israeli bombs. And they were initially, they were supposed to be able to fire them from within, like before crossing the line of conflict,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, as standoff weapons from inside your own border, But I mean, I don't know what happened, but in
weather.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But also, it's tricky when you're having French planes firing Israeli missiles backed up by Russian fighters running cover for them. I mean, that's not good. I mean, Pakistan with a single big supplier in the U.S. might have the advantage that way.
Yep. Yeah, and in any event, if an F-16 is going to use something Israeli, there's already an enormous amount of experience with that. Right. So they would be a lot. They would make a lot more sense.
Oh, yeah, the Kafir fighter that Israel uses is basically a stolen F-16.
Yeah, but shh, don't tell anybody. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, we should watch that. I mean, as I said to you, John, I mean, I started following Modi's rise before he actually took power, and a lot of it was thanks to how I first actually got to know Aditya Vellavelli, who has been a guest on this show, and he really kind of trained me up or educated me or got me to watch Modi. And as I've said, I mean, Modi is, you know, he's he comes out of the tradition of what you would call fascism or neo-fascism or something. Certainly he rose up through the ranks of the RSS, which was founded in the 20s, explicitly modeled on Mussolini's black shirts. And you know, he's not like one of the dumb, crazy, he's not a Bolsonaro type at all, or a Trump, he's not a buffoon. He's a really talented, he's one of those guys, one of those politicians that, you know, there's just some of them that nothing ever seems to touch them no matter what they do. And they just seem to have this way of having this kind of weird, scary distance that no one can seem to really cross or get at them. He's got an unusual talent. I don't know how else to put it. He's
right,
and particularly among right wing politicians. And you know, it's believed, and I think it's still quite possible, he could be really as transformative of India, which was founded as a socialist democratic state, but and still has a lot of that there. He could be what Thatcher was to England, which was a very radical revolutionary sort of, in a reactionary way, right-wing leader. I think Modi is that kind of leader in India. But in the last sort of 6 months to a year, he's faced the only time in his 5 years, he's faced some actual real problems that have hit his popularity. He did this demonetization campaign where they took out, I think I talked about this before, and he lost a couple of state elections, his parties did, that really surprised him. And
well, there's nothing like a small war to bring the popularity back. So this is something we're definitely going to have to track, and maybe it's time to have Aditya back on.
Yes.
And we'll probably have, unfortunately, fresh military news.
Yeah,
I think on a small scale.
I do too, but I just...
This is a stylized war, but it's a stylized war that's going to have casualties.
I mean, I just can't imagine that Modi can leave it like this. I don't think Modi wants... In fact, when Aditya and I used to talk about, you know, what's Modi going to do when he has his political crisis? We talked about this years ago. All the signs we were getting was he was going to go after internal enemies. He was just not as, in a sense, Congress is kind of more interested, the center-left party, in saber-rattling, as they call it, rattling things up with Pakistan than
Modi.
I think
something has happened in Pakistan. A lot of things happened in Pakistan at the same time. The IMF suddenly got very friendly and released huge funds to the Pakistani state. Mohammed bin Salman came to visit and distributed $20 billion in prizes and freed 2,100 Pakistani prisoners inside Saudi Arabia. The U.S. suddenly started looking in a more kindly light on Pakistan. And
And then the next thing you know, Pakistan-backed Salafi radicals blow up some Iranians and blow up some Indians. Yeah, so it's pretty gross. It's pretty horrible, but that's
empire. It's undoubtedly going to give us many more happy notes to follow. Yeah. But now, because we have to finish the show so that poor Brendan can get it produced and out there in time, you should probably...
Yeah, let's wrap this up. So so we'll keep an eye on that. And I do too, if you're listening, get ready, because we're going to want to get a little bit more insight into all this. Again, thank you to Joel Whitney for talking about his book, Finks, and the CIA's role in the Cultural Cold War. Thank you again, Brendan, and to all of our subscribers. This is the last episode of the month of February. We'll see you next month. Thanks again, John, too.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Brendan. Bye-bye. Joel, bye.